Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about the publishing industry today, and we'll be speaking with Mariel Nanasi of New Energy Economy about what happened environmentally during the legislative session. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Pari Noskin-Tiker. She is a mystery author, and we've talked about her books on the air before, and she is organizing a convention called Left Coast Crime 2011, which is happening in Santa Fe very soon, starting on the 24th of March. And this convention is called The Big Chili.
Yes.
Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
So what is this kind of convention all about?
It's basically a celebration of crime fiction, and it has it's a coming together of writers and fans. These are fan-run conventions overall, and we have panels. People just get to meet each other and talk to each other, and it's extremely welcoming, and you know, you get to meet all of the people you've always wanted to meet and have breakfast with them, hang out with them, you know, sit in the lobby.
Famous
mystery authors like Martin Cruz Smith, and who wrote Gorky Park, that's probably his most famous book, and Margaret Cole and Nancy Atherton. I mean, big names are coming to this thing.
Big names indeed, and a lot of them. There's
a lot of
pages and pages and pages
in the program book. Yes, we've got about 180, you know, various degrees of fame and so forth, you know, and everything from people who write hobby mysteries or collecting mysteries about, you know, little dollhouse collectibles, all the way to the darkest of the dark, violent, you know, noir novels. So the whole spectrum.
So they show up, and then their fans show up, and
yep.
Presumably among their fans are also aspiring mystery writers themselves.
There are some, you know, we do have some programming that involves how-to or those kinds of things, but a lot of them, you know, we're all readers and lovers of crime fiction. And so every author who's, you know, worth his or her grain, his or her salt, is also an enthusiastic reader.
Yeah.
And so it's a chance for you to talk about issues and so forth on these panels that you just, you won't hear these discussions anywhere else.
Among, well, I guess any subculture, whether it be Star Trek conventions or mystery writer conventions, there are fans who are so knowledgeable and just downright obsessive.
And there are a lot of them, yes. And there are people who read 300 books a year.
Yeah.
I mean, really and truly. And who keep libraries and lists and, you know, categorize them, and who have the first editions. I mean, in this convention will have book dealers and stuff where you can get first editions of some of these writers that you just can't find anywhere else. And so you have the obsessive fans, you have the enthusiasts. One of the things about Left Coast Crime, it's mandated in our bylaws that the name badges can't have any distinction. It can't say author or fan or writer. I mean, it says, for example, I'm the chair of the convention, so ours is going to be a different color. But so you end up sitting with people who may be very famous that you just haven't heard of.
Right.
And these wonderful conversations strike up in the bar or whatever, and it's just, it's really fun.
And there's an equalizing effect to that.
That's the whole intent.
For everybody.
That's the intent.
I bet there are people who have read all 29 books by a particular author.
Sure.
And who can tell you about the little white dog that appeared in books 3 and was a little bit bigger in book 7. And
who accidentally became a brown dog in book 13. You know? Oh, yeah. I mean, and who can tell you what word was omitted on page 43 of book 17. And oh, yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting. So people, I suppose ordinary people who also want to just go and who are not on that level of fandom.
Which is most of
which
the
is,
people who attend.
Yeah. They go and they learn. And is it also an opportunity to buy books?
Oh, absolutely. Buy books. I mean, the whole shebang. And we actually decided to open day passes for New Mexicans. When I agreed to do this convention in New Mexico and Santa Fe, and I picked La Fonda, one of the things, I mean, I write about New Mexico, and I wanted to show off my home state. I mean, that's the whole reason I volunteered. Well, I didn't volunteer. I agreed to volunteer to chair this convention. And so we have people coming from England, from Canada, from all over the U.S., but not that many New Mexicans. So I decided to have day passes. We just opened them up.
Ah, nice.
So that on Sunday and Thursday, because they're half days, there will be a lower price than on Friday and Saturday.
So Left Coast Crime, what is it? It's an organization that does a convention every year. What do they do?
It does a convention every year. The convention travels basically west of the Mississippi, but there have been Left Coast crimes in Birmingham, England, and in Hawaii. So, you know, in El Paso and Monterey, California. I mean, they've been all over. There was one in New Mexico in Albuquerque about 12 or 14 years ago. That's the last time, and probably there won't be one in New Mexico again.
For a while.
For a long time. The organization has been around for 20 years.
So are there a lot of mysteries? I mean, we certainly know some of them. I've had authors on the air, Michael McGarity, and everybody knows about Tony Hillerman. But are there a lot of, and you,
thank you,
mysteries set in New Mexico?
There are a fair number. Probably writers are not as well known. I think Douglas Preston, and he just wrote another one that takes place in New Mexico. There are a lot of Southwestern writers, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of them will be at Left Coast Crime.
Does mystery writing tend to be regional?
Not particularly. I think that labels happen. So you write about what you know, whether it's New Mexico or the South or whatever, and then you get labeled as a Southwestern writer or a Southern writer simply because of location. But I don't think that's the initial intent.
Unless you're from New York.
If you're right, that's exactly right. Or Boston. You know, I mean, people don't talk about Boston
as
mysteries
a regional,
or
yeah.
Northeast mysteries, but they exist. And, you know, there are a lot of Minnesotan writers.
Right.
So they're the Minnesota UP mysteries.
Right. There are also a lot of mystery writers who write series. So there is one detective who shows up book after book, and characters appear and disappear and reappear again. And so that gives you, I don't know, I mean, do people tend to plan, okay, I've got 10 or 15 books in front of me? Or
I think it depends on the writer. And one of the panels that we're going to have, if people go to our website, they can go to the page that says program, and they can click on something saying grid, and they can actually see all the panels. And one of the panels has to do with writing series as opposed to standalones, because a lot of writers will write a series for a while and then think, you know, I want to visit something else, or I want to explore something else. So they'll write a standalone, and then their fans will clamor and say, oh, please, you know, we want to go back to this world, please. And so they'll write another, you know, in the series and so forth. From my own experience, I know that when I wrote the three Sasha books, I was thinking in terms of a series from the beginning.
And what is amazing about that is how this fictional world becomes so real that fans can't bear to leave it.
It's true. It's absolutely true. And writers like Donna Andrews, who have, you know, a lot of books, or Nancy Atherton with Aunt Dimity, you know, these people, their fans, you know, just love being in those worlds. And they want to go back again and again. And if the author doesn't write new books, they'll just keep rereading the old ones.
Right.
You know, they don't want to leave it.
Right. Yeah. Now, there are one of the programs is about supernatural mysteries.
Yes.
Are there a lot of those? Is it the sci-fi mystery genres come together?
It's you're finding this trend in mystery and in romance, and all over the place. You're finding this urge toward the paranormal. And so, and you know, I mean, we're in Santa Fe. We're in New Mexico. We have to have at least one panel that does with that anyway.
Well, if we're in Santa Fe, we should have at least one on science in that case, because we're as much of a science as a spiritual town.
We have a panel on forensics. We have a panel on research, so we're cutting it, yeah.
We're talking to Pari Noskin-Tikert about Left Coast Crime 2011, The Big Chili, and I love the little logo with the chili carrying a gun.
Well, and he's got a fedora, too, if you notice.
Of course. Now, you've been, in your own time, volunteering to do this for a couple of years now, organizing this big event, which will not happen in New Mexico again anytime soon. Tell us some of the highlights of the, besides being able to meet all these authors in a semi-random way, but what are some of the highlights of the four-day event, which starts this Thursday?
Yes, we there are several special programs, but probably the one that I would like to talk most about for New Mexicans is on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. Michael McGarity will interview Tanya Harris, who is the widow of Sergeant Joe Harris, who was the policeman who was ambushed in the Jemez Mountains by the Cookie Bandit. And this is the first time that she is speaking publicly about her husband's death in any detail. And it's called Officer Down. And I think that it's going to be an extraordinarily moving and once-in-a-lifetime kind of an event. And I'm just really looking forward to it.
There's something that's very, when I think about people who are writers about crime, now Michael McGarity was a police officer and he's really had a lot of contact with some not so nice people. But for a writer who is full of creative ideas but hasn't necessarily spent their life walking among the scum of the earth, killers, kidnappers, and so on, that whole question of how you get and transmit information, I mean, it's fiction, but it also has to be accurate. How you do that accurately is something I always wonder about.
It's really interesting. I know many, many resources. There are resources online. There are listservs with forensics folks and so forth that you can go on and sign on. And crimewriters.com, I think, is one of these where you can just ask questions and you have CSI folks and poison folks and so on and so forth who will answer your questions. I have a friend now who knows everything you'd want to know about poisons, and when I need that kind of detail, I turn to her, and she knows, you know, she knows I'm not insane and that I'm not going to really use it in real life. But you do walk a very fine line, because you want to be accurate, but you also want to be careful not to give too much information. I think that you and I discussed this when I wrote the Socorro Blast, that I had gotten a lot of information about how to build bombs.
Right.
And
off of the internet.
Well, no, I refused. I did it all in person.
Ah.
No. I didn't do anything off the internet.
Because if you do that, let's say you Google and you find out all sorts of information about how to get bombs on the internet, will somebody be showing up on your doorstep?
I'm too paranoid. And with a name, my first name is an Iranian name. And I've just had a couple things happen in my life that make me just paranoid enough that I did all my interviews in person. But I also got a lot of information that I had to decide not to use.
Because
same with poisons. I decided not to.
I'd be giving ideas.
Exactly. I'd be giving people ideas,
right.
And I decided not to.
And there have been examples of that. There was a really 10th-rate movie that came out, I don't know, I think it was in the 80s or 90s, that had a horrible killing in it in New York in the subway. And a few days after it came out, somebody did what was in the movie. It had never been done before. It was horrible, horrible.
Yeah, the responsibility of the writer, I mean, no matter how many disclaimers we make about this is a work of fiction and so on and so forth, you know, people will be influenced, and you don't have any control about it, but you can at least be more mindful. Just like when you write about death and you write about murder, you know, this is not funny. I write funny mysteries,
right.
But it's not, the act of it, it's not funny, and I console myself with the fact that justice is served. Most people who write or read crime fiction want justice. And part of the reason they read crime fiction is to get that justice, whether it's in a thriller, whether it's in a sweet little, you know, cozy mystery or whatever. That's what they're looking for. That's the satisfaction. Whether they're looking for the puzzle or the adrenaline, the ultimate payoff is that satisfaction. The only exception to that is noir.
Uh-huh.
And noir fiction oftentimes doesn't give you that payout.
Right. Now, if you're writing a series, do you leave maybe one or two threads not tied up so that you can pick them up again and somebody who wasn't brought to justice, but
yes,
one or two books later, they, okay.
I know a lot of people who do that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're talking about Left Coast Crime 2011, The Big Chili. This is really a big deal that this is happening here in Santa Fe. It's funny, people are probably talking about it all over the world, and here least of all.
It's very true. And you know, we debated about when we were going to try and publicize it where and so forth. I was overwhelmed. I had expected this convention to be about 250 people or so, and I thought, oh, this is manageable at La Fonda and so forth. We have close to full registrants, we have about 450, and then we've got day passes. I fully expect we'll have 500-plus people at this thing. So it's doubled, and it's like this, you know, an extraordinary hydra at this point. You know, for me as the convention chair, just sort of, okay, what's happening and who's coming and where? And every day offers new opportunities and new challenges.
Indeed.
Her voice squeaks.
So the website is leftcoastcrime.org. It's
/2011.
Right. And it'll work. It'll go right there. If you Google that or just type it right in, and you can find out about the program and all kinds of other stuff, and we will see you there.
That sounds great. I just want to give a shout out to my committee and thank them publicly on the radio, because they have worked harder than I could ever imagine.
Pari Noskin-Tikert, mystery writer and organizer, chair of Left Coast Crime 2011, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Charlie Newton. He's a crime fiction author. We spoke to him about his first book, Calumet City, several years ago, and he is here for the Left Coast Crime Convention. He will be speaking and moderating a panel for Left Coast Crime on Friday morning at 10:15. It's called The Many Faces of Violence, and his book, Calumet City, a special edition, the first edition, will be on sale there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello.
So you have a new book coming out soon, and you'll be back probably in the fall or winter to talk about that. But I thought we could talk today about the changes in the publishing industry that you've seen since you started writing. What have you seen? What was it like when you started writing fiction 10 or 15 years ago compared to now?
Well, it's sort of the same distribution channel destruction that you've seen worldwide, and I kind of think it's based on the fact that distribution channels were very heavy, fat, and overweighted in the first place, but also primarily because of the internet allowed people to not have to have bricks and mortar stores and lots of money and mortgages and corporate connections, and they could sell you stuff that they made personally or that they acquired some way outside the distribution channel. And publishing, it used to have little bookstores all over, and they were mom and pops, and they recommended to you what they had read and their staff had read, and that they hand-sold was the term.
Which we still have here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, I must say.
I did my very first book signing at
Garcia Street Books.
Garcia Street Books. Yeah. Anyway, so as the marketplace has begun to address all this fat in the distribution channel, you're starting to see Borders, they're in bankruptcy, Barnes & Noble suspending their dividend, all the other what are called big box retailers that fundamentally put the little bookstore out of business, just like the Bed Bath & Beyond put the little linen stores in Walmart and everybody else. That big box retail model was one where major corporations could go from direct from warehouse to fundamentally another warehouse, drop ship thousands and thousands of items, and it was very efficient. Gave a better price to the population, put mom and pop and Main Street out of business. That worked for X length of time until the Koreans and the Japanese and the Vietnamese and the Chinese and everybody else started using a lower cost labor component to make the same stuff, and then they could ship it to Best Buy.
Now, when you talk about the Koreans and the Japanese, are you still talking about books?
Well, I'm talking about anything that has a labor component to it. And where I'm going here as it relates to books is, as Amazon came to the fore, initially laughed at, Amazon always had the plans on being a publisher. They always had plans on using books as a loss leader for any other product that they might handle, again, non-bricks and mortar.
What does a loss leader mean?
Loss leader is you can sell something for less than you pay for it if you can get the people in the store to buy something that has a higher profit margin.
So you sell a book for $10 that cost you $11, but then you sell a pair of sneakers or a blender.
Or you sell some other book that isn't a loss leader. And we'll come to that in a minute, why that's well, I guess I'll do it for you now, is Amazon, as it grew then, it has a contract, or had a contract, I don't know where they are now, with the major publishers to where they cannot return the books that they ask for. Barnes & Noble can. If within 6 weeks, they can send back anything. So can Borders, so can all the big box ones, which has really crushed the publishers because the person selling the books doesn't have to sell them like a grocery store sells oranges. They don't have to worry about spoilage and loss and all that. They just say, okay, it didn't sell, send these back. Publisher eats them, sends them some new ones. So they're basically in the shelving business, those big box retailers. If somebody else puts the inventory on the shelves, they got to pay the rent for the shelves, but somebody else just sends them stuff.
So it really is less in their interest to sell any particular book because they're going to be able to send it back and get their money back, so they're not selling the way a smaller mom-and-pop store might.
Well, what they did was they bought into the bestseller channel, which was they would get a 45% discount and up to 50% depending on who they were. And so a $27.50 book, they're only in it at $13.50. They would then discount it to you 30%, make the 20%, which is a decent retail markup for them, and line their shelves with James Patterson and all this other big box kind of bestseller behavior, pushing out anybody that might not have that kind of backing from their publisher.
At least on the tables. I mean, the things that you see when you first walk in. I mean, obviously, in Borders, their shelves are full of many non-bestseller titles.
Well, go look at the first three rows of shelves and see that there might be 10 authors on them total, and there might be 30 or 40 feet of James Patterson. And there might be 20 face-out copies of the same book. And, again, the reason for that was it was very efficient. You didn't have to be right. The publisher was putting tons of money behind that name, and so the public came in and bought them. Well, what Amazon did to them is they signed a contract where they would get 50 to 55%, and they couldn't return them. They signed that contract, and then they turned around and put them on their site for that number, less than what Barnes & Noble and Borders could pay for them. Consequently, anybody with sense is going to go to Amazon and buy that book there.
Right.
This crippled the big box guys because that's all they're known for. They're not known for hand selling. I forget who said this, but they said you go into a big box retailer and everybody in the store is unhappy. The people that work there are unhappy. The people that are in there are unhappy in the middle of the day. It's not the old kind of book model where you walk in and touch the books and you know the person. It's like being in a saloon that you like.
Right.
And I'm not saying that big boxes, some Barnes & Nobles, there's one in New York that's fabulous. There's a Borders in Chicago that's fabulous. But overall, it became a corporate mentality just like Walgreens. And it worked as long as it was the cheapest way to buy that kind of book or that kind of toothpaste. As soon as Amazon came in and turned the world upside down, it ended everything. So you've got a corporate mentality in New York for the publishers that says we're going to give these books on consignment to our major part of the distribution channel, but they're failing. We're going to sell it for cash to this monster who now has an electronic portal. And here's what's important. Amazon knows who you are when you buy from them. Fun that we joke about it, but so they know your height, your weight, where you live, your eye color, your sexual orientation. They have history on you.
How do they know your eye color?
They don't, but I mean, you know what I'm saying, is that yeah. The publisher, like my original publisher was Simon & Schuster, they have no idea who bought my books. They know where they shipped them, but they don't know who they sold them to.
Whereas Amazon, they have, every time I have gone there, they have recommendations for me based on the last three things that I've bought.
They got a profile on it. Whatever their economic profile is what should we sell to Mary Charlotte based on her consumptive behaviors historically.
Right, dog books and whatnot.
Well, maybe how your credit card works. I don't know how far it goes, but I know they've now started making pitches to authors direct and saying, we want to publish your book. And last time you got $50,000 and you sold 12,000 books. A book just like yours on ours sold 20,000. Tell you what. We're going to do it electronically, and of the $10, we'll give you half. So if you sell 20, like this guy did, at $5, you can get $100,000 with us. And before the author can say yes, they add, and we'll tell you who bought it. You're going to know your customer. There's going to be a profile for you of who's actually reading the stuff you write. Well, that's brand new. I mean, that's big, because
In your view, are there privacy issues about that?
I mean, I don't know that there are any more, any less than Walgreens. You know, you know that when you go to the internet or use your credit card in a restaurant or somebody asks you for your zip code or phone number when you go buy something in a store, that they're cataloging you to contact you. They're thinking about their customer. If you don't want to do that, pay cash and you don't have to think about it.
And wear sunglasses.
And wear sunglasses. Right.
We're talking to...
I'm gonna put mine on now.
We're talking to Charlie Newton. So with all of this, the extra factor is electronic books, which have gone way up in terms of the percentage of people who are buying books on Kindle or iPad or whatever their medium is versus buying an actual paper book.
Half of Amazon sales, they say, are now electronic. Now, here's what's stunning is my age group, the people over 45, is the fastest growing user of this electronic technology. And they would have told you before that anybody over 45, 50, 55, 60 is not going to be inclined to read on a Kindle. Well, it's so potent that now you have an argument. This further damages the hard publishers. You have this argument between Google, who's in now, Apple, who's in, Sony, and Amazon. Amazon's got the best portal now, but those four companies got more money than Fort Knox. And so they're competing for this electronic portal. The publishers, the hard publishers, the guys that I'm married to now, the best one in the world, Doubleday, they have to decide, how do we compete with that? How do we have a place in that world? Because nobody can line the shelves on a video monitor. It's only X big. Somebody's got to tell us now how to go through this sea of books. I mean, there's a lot of them out there now. There's going to be 10 times as many when it costs nothing to publish them. When you can write a book, pay Amazon a small fee, and they'll put it on their catalog, and so instead of 6 million, there's 60 million books. And those people are people like you. The world's going to come down, back down to hand selling. And in the electronic version of hand selling, it'll be the blogosphere. There'll be a whole bunch of Siskel and Eberts that mean what they say, that aren't advertising, that are passionate about romances or passionate about crime or mystery or whatever it is, sci-fi. And they're going to talk amongst themselves, and they're going to recommend the stuff, and they're going to be proud as hell of the stuff that's good and say, this is somebody that you should read and support because it's fabulous, entertaining, and this stuff is crap. Stay away from this. And you can't, the big guys can't sue them. They can't beat them to death because they're just people. They don't have the assets to make it worthwhile, so their opinions will stand. And some of you, like you've done in New Mexico with a radio show, will rise even higher in the blogosphere and be looked to by a larger audience. And that audience, you'll be able to change how things happen in New York because you reach 20,000 people and you have somebody like me on the show and you sell 1,000 books, let's say. The guy named Rick Hogan in Chicago that has that kind of clout in the morning, and you're going to see that the number of those people multiplied with more and more of these little Mary Charlottes everywhere.
So not only people who are writing blogs, but people who are doing radio shows on books, local, low-power FM, cable TV, those kinds of things on books will affect publishing in a way that didn't happen so much when you had a table full of bestsellers when you walk in the big box store.
What we think is probably going to happen is going on in San Francisco now, where you're going to see, like we're sitting in a restaurant that you run your radio show from, you'll see a combination of, say, let's pick Starbucks, where I think they have 12,000 outlets. And for Starbucks to make any money, they got to get you to the store. They got to sell you coffee live. And so they'll combine a Starbucks with the Mary Charlotte radio station, not just a show, and a bookstore. And those three things, the bookstore will have tables out front with Cinzano umbrellas so that people driving by will know there's energy here. And just think of it as the modern equivalent of the Beat Generation's coffee houses. Those people didn't have a voice, didn't have a distribution channel, is another way to say it, and they thought they had something to say, be they drug addicts or alcoholics or whatever, artists, they had all the downside of this, you know, lifestyle, but they also had something to say, many of them. And so they went to these coffee houses, and the energy they brought to it, the realism they brought to it, was bigger than the drug addiction and alcohol and stupidity that often, you know, stoner poetry or whatever, out of that you get Dylan and Lenny Bruce, you get Ginsberg, you get Kerouac, you get, and I'm not saying these people are fabulous, but they meant it, and the public flocked to them. I honestly believe you're going to get that again across the country because it marries that little Oprah blogosphere beautifully, and that ain't going away.
What do you mean by little Oprah blogosphere?
People like you that don't have a national TV contract but can be easily picked up by hundreds of bloggers who agree with what you're doing once they know you're doing it. That whatever show you and I do, if you began, I don't know what you're going to do with your show, but if you began to push it towards interacting with this network of blogs across the country, there's a woman called Sarah Weinman has Confessions of the Idiosyncratic Mind. I highly recommend anybody that is interested in crime fiction look that up on the internet. And she's really powerful. She's columnist with the LA Times. And she does this on her own. And she pulls no punches. She isn't beholden to anybody. And you'll end up connected to that family because you're the same way and you're of the same scale and size and power. And we, the public, will look to you, our personal favorites, either in person going down to that Beat Generation coffee house or look to you on the internet before we spend our $27.50 or our $10 electronically. We'll look for reviewers that we believe. Like you used to, you're probably too young to remember Cronkite in a significant way, but we used to believe Huntley and Brinkley and
Walter Cronkite.
We didn't think about it like talking heads selling whatever the next level of commercials are. And I've said this to you before, that all you have to do to look at the news and decide what's coming is look at who advertised there yesterday in the opening slot, the middle slot, and the last slot, and that'll tell you what stories you're going to see. Well, Cronkite and the boys, I don't know what they were truthfully like, but we didn't think they were like that. The blogosphere has the ability and high probability of being emotionally truthful.
And that is something that when people talk about the way society is, basically consumerism and a bunch of overproduced junk that we don't need and trying to shove basically the intellectual and moral equivalent of junk food down our throats, you're talking about something that is genuine and authentic due to these changes in the publishing industry.
I think it's going to come back to you have far less disposable income because you're not buying on credit, you're buying with cash, and it's going to have to strike you that this is good entertainment, that it's good medication, it's whatever you use books for or clothing for or food for. It has to matter in a different way, so it has to be sold to you in a different way. And whenever I come back to America every year, sometimes for 2 or 3 months, or now in this case 4 or 5 months, and what always stuns me is the amount of information being shoved at me to buy something. It's endless. And if you're here, you're kind of immune to it because that's all you've seen. But if you go to Africa for 6 or 7 months and then come back, you know, you lose all the horror of that experience half the time. But when you get here, you're like, holy, stop.
Right.
You can't watch terrestrial television just because the commercials drive you insane. You can't, you know, you're looking at Burger King and McDonald's and all these other things, you know. And as I've said, you know, McDonald's is a classic example. So they open a Ronald McDonald House. And which is, well, great if you're a rape victim and that kind of stuff. But then the 99% of their behavior is selling obesity and poison to children. And nobody's paying attention to that. And, you know, we could spend 2 days talking about the disconnect between mission and message here and what that's led to, which is where we are now. And the record business felt this first, and then the car business, and now the publishing business. The publishing business, like I said, luckily when I left Simon & Schuster, I went to Doubleday with Jason Kaufman, who was the editor of the Da Vinci Code. So I'm with the best publisher in the world, the most powerful editor in the world. And here's what I think is interesting about that. The stuff that I write is not bestseller, beach read, happy ever after.
Well, it's crime fiction. Lots of people read that.
Yeah, but Calumet City was nominated for every major award there was. The first time in history that all those groups agreed on that, even to the point of nominating it. But my publisher, Simon & Schuster, didn't want to do anything with it. And one of the elements that's interesting is I don't think Doubleday would have had a spot for me hardcover in the fall if the old model still worked. If the idea that you can sell 200,000-400,000 books or you can't be with a major big hitter outfit like Doubleday, they don't have any expectation like that for me. But they're proud of what I wrote. They think it, if you ever walk in their lobby in New York, you'll just start crying. I mean, you start looking at its three stories of the best books ever written, all the old tattered covers, and it's a temple. And I'm not saying I deserve to be in Bookcase, but I mean, I'm at least mopping the floors, right? So, I mean, I'm in the crew. And I think that's as much a function of the change in the distribution channels.
So, in other words, they might, if the changes in the distribution channels, including Amazon and electronic publishing, hadn't happened, they might not be taking risks on new authors doing heartfelt quality stuff as opposed to proven stuff that will sell. Am I interpreting you correctly?
Yeah, and I think, and I can't speak for Kaufman, hell of a guy. I love him to death for taking his shot with me, and he really worked on the book a lot with me before he bought it even. He, I think, would tell you that if it's his decision, he absolutely would do it. But, you know, he's a multinational corporation, and even though he's one of the biggest stars in the industry, he's still got a board of directors down there that has a business plan, and it's sort of like back the Mamas and the Papas when they were saying, you know, I forget what song it was, but you have to read between the lines. I think a lot of these world-class editors like Kaufman have had to buy books that slipped under the radar of maybe the corporate business plan and then sneak it in there, or it's like George Clooney does two blockbuster movies in order to make two that for some reason he thinks matter to him. That whole management necessity is changing because nobody really knows. One other comment about that, when I made the comment about music, Ed Cherney's, I grew up with, a really good friend of mine, is recording engineer for Rolling Stones, Bonnie Raitt, Clapton. I mean, he's won 3 or 4 Grammys and Emmys. And the guy's just the world-class record producer. And he and I were talking a couple days ago, and he said, you can't make money with recorded music. People don't even steal it anymore. They just get it on YouTube and listen to it. And I said, well, geez, Ed, what, you know, is Springsteen going to stop? You know, and he said, well, no, it's now a different business. You can make a small living on tour, local tour. The ticket prices have gotten to the point now that you're interacting with people's inability to pay them. And if the economy gets worse, that's going to get worse. So those artists who were playing 30 and 40,000 now might play 10,000, and the ones who were playing 10 might play 3, and everybody else is, you know, good luck. Because you can't sell them that stuff. Well, we're in the same intellectual property business, right? I mean, I write a book. I spend a year and a half.
But you can't put it on YouTube. So you have the advantage of somebody has to actually download it and pay their $10, if not $27.50.
That's the current state of it. But there were times when they said they couldn't steal the songs. And so I don't think I would want to plan on that there aren't some really smart 15-year-olds out there that are figuring out how to crack the code on guided missiles. You know, I mean, where I'm going is, I believe that it comes down to this sense of community that we haven't had since the 50s, and the collision, the Beats, the hippies in the 60s, on and on and on. I think we're going back to that, to where it's not like honor society, but it's, I want to go down to that store. Just describing that store to you, I want to go there.
I want to go there, too.
Yeah, and
we got two components here in the baking company. We got the radio and the coffee.
Right.
And some very good burritos.
Yeah. And so, as I see the real estate business crumble because people can't pay the rents, I see better class of facility available to this kind of beat generation coffee house. If you go down to the plaza in Santa Fe, and, you know, 2 years ago I told you there were 10 storefronts vacant because they couldn't lease them to anybody, you'd start laughing. Well, that's true now. and then the periphery to this really high value real estate's even more vacant than that, and the bad news hasn't hit yet. So if somebody with a dream who didn't do a business plan and doesn't know that the chances of failure are absolutely almost guaranteed puts up all their money, goes down there and opens up that little restaurant, that little taco stand, and, you know, they got a radio station they put together with their own computer because you can do that now,
and their
right?
low-power FM.
Right, yeah, and they go down there and start, and next thing you know, the intelligentsia or the artists or the gay people or the homeless or whoever's going to adopt them adopts them, and they have a viable community. And that community, I think, is the key word, is you end up with lots of this connective community, and it's all across the country. You're no longer going to the big guy to speak to you. Rush Limbaugh on the radio. I was in Nashville when I ran into my first Rush room. I had no idea what they were talking about. And all these grown-ups in suits and ties were in this segment of the bar, on the other side of the bar in the dining room, listening to the radio, some guy, Rush Limbaugh, talking while they ate their lunch. Well, that's, you know, this was 20-some years, 25 years ago. That's kind of where we're going on a small scale, where a place that's us, the neighborhood tavern of Chicago, only it ain't about alcohol.
And it ain't about Limbaugh.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a great speaker. You know, the stuff he says is insane, but, I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard him speak, as you sit back and go, the guy's professional. He's really good. Well, that's probably his last 25 years. But, I mean, I think the key part of that to me was that where we're going doesn't require alcohol as a congregative reason. And the Beat Coffee Houses, initially, not that coffee's not a drug, but the Beat Coffee Houses were about a place to have a voice for people that didn't think they had one. And I tell you, for all the connective capabilities now, I hear that more than anything, is nobody's listening to me. The right thinks nobody's listening. The left thinks nobody's listening. The people with an education don't think so. The people with no driver's license and no immigration cards, they don't think anybody's listening. And nobody. And so finding a place that doesn't have church or alcohol connected to it, that you can go and fit into something that seems to be helping you towards where you want to go, or informing you, or making you comfortable, I think it's highly likely.
Charlie Newton is a crime fiction writer, and once again, he'll be speaking at the Left Coast Crime Convention and moderating a panel called Many Faces of Violence on Friday at 10:15 in the morning. His first book is called Calumet City. He'll have some first editions of it there. And the next book is coming out this fall, and with any luck, we'll have you back in Santa Fe to talk about it.
If you will buy me all that alcohol I said didn't matter, I'll come back.
Charlie Newton, thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Good seeing you.
We're going to take a little break. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the show Marielle Nanasi. She's the executive director of New Energy Economy. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Good morning. So this is the first of probably several recaps of the legislative session, which just ended last Saturday at noon. How did New Mexico's environment fare in terms of the laws that were passed and not passed during this session?
Well, as you can recall, Mary Charlotte, is that then-governor, elect Martinez had campaigned on killing the greenhouse gas reduction rules that were adopted by the Environmental Improvement Board in late 2010. And then after...
With the help of New Energy Economy, that was one of the campaigns that you worked on.
Exactly. It was our petition before the Environmental Improvement Board. And then one of the first things that she did when she was governor was fail to publish our rule, adopted rule, in the New Mexico Register. We then took her to a court, in the very first case in the New Mexico Supreme Court, where she lost. And the New Mexico Supreme Court said that she was not above the law, that she needed to follow the law and actually publish our rules, which just in essence gives notice to people of what the laws of New Mexico are.
So those are the rules of the state of New Mexico until further notice.
Correct. And they reduce carbon pollution by 3% a year starting in 2013 from the largest polluters. And there was a number of attempts in the legislature, about seven of them, to repeal the carbon reduction pollution rules. And they basically were at the behest of the greatest polluters in New Mexico, and in conjunction with Governor Martinez. And basically, she didn't get what she wanted, thank goodness.
And so why was that?
Well, they're intact, because I think that the carbon pollution reduction rules are intact, and as well as, I'll say one other thing, is the renewable energy, renewable portfolio standard.
And that's intact, too.
That's intact, too. And PNM and the other larger polluters in New Mexico try to repeal those environmental regulations. And I think that, thank goodness, there's some progressive legislators. I want to give a shout out to Senator Worth and Senator McSorley and Senator Griego particularly, who really stood up and said, we need to have forward momentum, and that there is an emerging clean energy market in New Mexico. That's where the jobs are. That's what the people want. There was a great study that just came out from Colorado College that said New Mexicans by far believe that we can grow the economy and protect the environment. And that's what we believe. We believe that coal is outdated technology, that is that a polluting strategy is of the past, that no longer needs our endorsement.
And as we talked about yesterday morning, solar power and wind power, is what we were talking about yesterday, they don't use any water.
Exactly.
Not only do they not pollute the water, but they don't even use it, which is a big deal in New Mexico.
It's a huge deal in New Mexico. Just so that everybody knows, the San Juan Generating Station uses 2.5 times as much water every year as the city of Santa Fe. So we were talking about a significant amount of water that goes in absolutely clean and comes out toxic.
And here we are being very careful about how much we water our little, you know, daffodils and things, and it's such a drop in the bucket compared to that, and not to mention hydraulic fracturing, which we've talked about and we'll surely talk about again in the future. What is New Energy Economy doing now?
Well, we have an exciting new partnership just signed last week, is a resolution with the Navajo Crown Point chapter. We will be not New Energy Economy, but we are the conduit for installing solar, and we hope to have solar on all the chapter houses on Navajo Nation as sort of like a lighthouse, a beacon for the future, to show, to not just talk about it, but actually to see it implemented, actually on the ground, so people can look up at the hub of cultural, political, social activity. Their buildings, their community centers, will be powered by renewable energy, the sun, that is not toxic, that doesn't cause asthma, that doesn't cause all the coal mining pollution that's rampant, especially on Navajo Nation,
and which is rather abundant.
Yes, the solar is abundant, and it shall provide, which is so exciting.
And which is very interesting in an area, Navajo land and a lot of Indian lands, that have had to make really rough choices about coal, about uranium mining, and have borne the brunt of the health consequences of those polluting industries.
That's exactly right. And that's why the transition to solar and other renewable technologies is so promising. We believe that it will be a job creator, that it will also impact enormously the health, have positive health impacts in the area.
If people want to get involved, for example, in putting solar panels in Navajo areas, is there anything that they can do?
Yes, first please go visit our website, newenergyeconomy.org, and you can go to the action pages, and you can actually donate, and your money will go directly to putting solar panels on a chapter house on Navajo Nation. Or if you're a solar engineer and you want to come up and do the installing yourself, please join us. We're actually going to have a solar installation weekend, long weekend, on starting on May 17th. On May 22nd, Crown Point Solar will be up and going. So we won't have to rely on dirty coal from PNM anymore.
Mariel Nanasi is Executive Director of New Energy Economy, on the web at newenergyeconomy.org. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.